Hare Krishna. Welcome back to the Bhagavata Bhakti Shastri course. So today we are continuing with the 7th chapter, Knowledge of the Absolute. We discussed in 7.7 in our previous class how Krishna is transcendent as well as immanent. There is no reality higher than Krishna. He is the highest reality, existing in a supreme glory. At the same time, he is pervading the whole world just as a thread pervades the necklace. Now in the next series of verses, Krishna will give examples of how he pervades material existence. So let us look at these verses. So we start at 7.8. Rasoham apsu kaunteya prabhasmi shashi suryayo pranavas sarvavedeshu shabdakhe paurusham drushu. So Rasoham apsu kaunteya. I am the taste of water, Krishna says then. Prabhashmi shashi suryayo. I am the light, the effulgence of the sun and the moon. Shashi is moon, suryayo is sun. Pranava sarvedeshu. I am the pranava, the omkar, that big is at the beginning, the invocation of the Vedic, many Vedic mantras. Shabda khe. I am sound in ether and Paurusham Drishu. I am Paurusha, the ability in man, Prabhupada translates. So, here Krishna is identifying himself with five objects. Now, what does this actually mean? There are many different philosophies. One of the philosophies is called as pantheism. Pantheism, pan means total, everything. So pantheism means everything is God. So is Krishna saying over here that everything is God? We will see in a later verse, in 7.12 at the end of this section, Krishna will say that I exist beyond there is all this thing. Abhit Guna will see that. Krishna says that Mamebhyaha Param Avyayam, that I am beyond these modes. So he talks about this 7.12 and 17.13 both. But here Krishna is not literally saying that when we talk about Krishna being the taste of water. So that is not that Krishna is reduced to only that. Krishna is that, but he is also much more. So here Krishna is talking about how he is the essence of everything. How just as thread is the essence of a necklace. A thread enables a necklace to exist as a coherent functional whole. Similarly, it is Krishna who allows everything to exist as a coherent function whole. So, water. Now, the first example itself is challenging. I am the taste of water. Now, according to a perspective of modern science, water is considered to be a tasteless liquid. So generally, you put some sugar or salt. So then we put say that it has a taste. However, that is just one way of looking at water to say that it is tasteless. But water does have a distinctive taste. So when we see that, and if you go to different places and sometimes we drink the water, we feel like the water here tastes different, the water here tastes different. So now we may say actually that difference of taste is because there are different things which are added to water. So that's why the water, the natural water in India may taste different from the natural water in Australia or in America or Africa. Even the natural water of the different holy rivers may taste to be different. So what does it actually mean when Krishna says, I am the taste of water? So is Krishna the taste of the water in India or Africa or Australia or what? Actually, the point which Krishna is making over here is much deeper. Now, in the Sankhya, when the evolution of the various elements is being described, at that time it is described that every sense object is associated with a particular element. So, for example, Shabda Khe, as Krishna tells in 7.8d, in this verse itself, in the last line he speaks this. So, when the creation unfolds, so from the subtle towards the gross, so at that time, one element evolves from the previous element. So from ether comes fire. Earth, water, air, fire. Bhumir apo nalo vayu khammano idrej. So from ether comes air, from air comes fire, from fire comes water, from water comes earth, like that. When it is coming like that, at that time, along with each particular element, a particular sense object associated with comes out. So the sense object associated with ether is sound. Similarly, sense object associated with water is taste. A sense object associated with fire is pursued with the eyes, and its form. A sense object associated with the earth is taste. It's fragrance, not taste. Punyo gandha prithivyam cha. In the next verse, Krishna will describe that. Punyo gandha, gandha, is fragrance. So, like that, there are each of the primary sense objects, they are associated with a particular element. So, the sense object of touch, sparsha, is associated with wind. Wind is felt through touch. So, when we say it is associated, what does it mean? That means that particular sense object facilitates us in the experience of that particular element, facilitates our experience of that particular sense object. For example, it is the presence of ether that enables sound to be transmitted, and thereby the elements, thereby we can hear sound. So that is Shabda K. So let's look at this one by one. We'll look at all these three which are mentioned by Krishna here, among which he is the essence. So now there's a concept of ether which is present in modern science. It was present in modern science. It was proposed at one particular time as an element which allows transmission, but then subsequently it has been rejected, it has been disproved. The idea that such an element exists is no longer considered to be valid. So then, if it's not considered to be valid, there were various experiments which apparently have proven that ether doesn't exist. So then, what is Bhagavad Gita's statement that ether is one of the elements mean? Actually, the modern science conception of ether and the Vedic conception of ether, the word may be the same, but the conception is different. And it's actually a different way of looking at matter. You know, even in Western intellectual history, there have been two fundamental ways of looking at matter. One is called the elemental theory of matter, and the other is the atomic theory of matter. Actually, this idea is that elemental theory of matter means matter is made of certain characteristic elements, and each element has its distinctive characteristics. So now, even when we use the word element in our Vedic philosophy, in our study of Krishna conscious texts, at that time we understand the word element is used in a sense different from what it is used in modern science. In modern science, the word element is used to refer to one particular type of existing object. So there are elements and there are compounds. So when there is bonding between two elements, we have what is called as compound. It's basic chemistry. Now, that is not the kind of element that is referred to when we talk about earth, water, fire, air, ether. So earth, water, fire, air, ether, these are the fundamental building blocks of material existence. Now, of course, earth, water, fire, ether may also have their own components, but each of them has its defining components. Now, the modern scientific idea is that there are elements, there are compounds, but although the word element may be there, today's scientific idea is primarily called as the atomic theory of matter. It is not so much the elemental theory. So even the atomic theory of matter is also there in among the six systems of philosophy. One of the systems of philosophy is called as Vaisheshika. And Vaisheshika is actually largely atomic theory of matter. So it talks about not matter, molecules. So either way, the point here is that these particular elements are, which are talked about in the Vedic culture, they are considered to have their own fundamental characteristics. Unlike that in modern science, we have the concept that there are elements, but they can be broken down into fundamental particles. So earlier it was atom, which is considered indivisible. Now we have further division of particles. And it's a complex and, as of now, incomprehensible idea of how from the subatomic world of mesons and protons and neutrinos and all those things, how from there, which actually most of them don't have any, they don't have any sense object associated with it. They don't have color. It's not that a atom or an electron or a molecule has a particular color or a particular fragrance or a particular taste. So they don't have it. But how was they build up? Then from at what particular time, suddenly the world which we see around us with all its variety and its individuality, every element is distinctive, it comes up, its distinctiveness and its variety comes up. It's quite incomprehensible. It's like if the Taj Mahal suddenly comes out of the foam. There is foam in the, say, Yamuna River. And the foam that is there, the foam basically is almost like non-material. Of course, it's material. But foam just comes for some time and it goes. It doesn't have any characteristics, practically speaking. It doesn't have any specific shape, fragrance, color. It doesn't have the artistry and the delicacy that is there in the Taj Mahal. But so say that from foam, suddenly Taj Mahal emerges. How it happens? What is the connection between this and this? So like that, the world which the elemental theory, the atomic theory of matter has gone down to in today's science. And from there, how the world that we know about through Vedic philosophy or through our daily experience. So the worldview of science and our world of daily experience, the connection between the two is not there actually, in terms of even conception. Okay, how are the two connected? How does this world emerge from that? We don't know. So basically our understanding is it's not that the atomic theory of matter is necessarily wrong. It is just one way of looking at the world. It is a map. So science is basically like a map. There are many eminent scientists who have talked about this, that science is essentially like a map. And a map maps certain features from the territory, from the reality. So this is a political map of India. In the political map, primarily the political divisions will be talked about. So in the political map, there are many features which are relevant for other characterizations will not be there. So similarly, if you want which area is at what level, above sea level, what height above sea level, which area is a plain, which area is a plateau, which area is a slope, which area is a mountain range. So all that features may not be so much in detail in a political map. But these are also important features which are real, but they are not there. So a map is no doubt a useful tool for navigating a territory. But it's important to recognize that map is not the territory. The map is a guide to the territory, and the territory is different from the map. Similarly, what science offers us is one way of looking at the world. And it is like a map. It is useful. In many ways it is remarkably useful, but what it describes is not the ultimate reality. What it describes is one representation of reality, one map of reality. And when we are saying that it's very There is no connection explainable between the map that science has come up with of all the subatomic particles and the world that we experience. He's simply pointing out that this map is incomplete. This doesn't mean it is incorrect. So when something is incomplete, that doesn't necessarily have to be incorrect unless the incomplete is thought to be complete. When the incomplete is mistaken to be complete, then the incomplete becomes incorrect. So, we don't have to make that mistake. So, we accept science as one map. But the Vedic scriptures are not bound by that map. They give us other ways of looking at reality also. So, one of those ways is this elemental theory of matter. So, the elemental theory of matter, the sense objects are the presence of the sense objects, where the sense objects come from, and how we see the various sense objects in the world of our experience, that is explained much more satisfactorily. So, it describes that associated with each of these elements, there is a sense object. So, in Krishna, and that element enables us to access and relish that sense object. And then that's why it is said that the sense object, that essence of the sense element, is the essence of that element is the sense object particularly. And that essence is Krishna. So, rasoham apsu kaunteya. So, rasa is taste. I am the taste of apsu. Apsu is water. What does this mean with all this background? Actually, taste becomes accessible to us through water. What does that mean? You know, if our secretory glands did not stop secreting saliva. Saliva is basically a transformation of water. It's primarily water with some other digestive chemicals added into it. You know, if the tongue stops secreting saliva, which is water, then you will not be able to taste anything. So similarly, an object to be tasty has to have some level of water presence in it. Generally, we say something is, if a chapati says, it's dry and tasteless. You know, a chapati doesn't have to be liquid like soup. But still, a chapati has to have some amount of liquidity. If liquid presence goes out of the chapati, then we say it's become dry, it's become tasteless. So, that means it's the presence of water that makes the tastes accessible to us. In that sense, the essence of water is its taste. So water is the medium by which we are able to experience taste. And that taste is Krishna. So what Krishna is saying over here? I am the underlying unifying essence of everything. So this is basically a section which enables us to understand that Krishna is not just present in far away in the spiritual world, but he's all around us. So Prabhupada quoted this verse once, the devotees were in, I think, Vishakhapatnam. This is described in Lilamrit. So, and they were at one of Prabhupada's godbrother's ashram, and nearby there was the ocean. So the devotees decided to go and bathe. And Prabhupada said, "Yeah, go and it's a sacred place. I think some holy place was there. The water over there was some holy place." So the devotees went to bathe, and their earlier experience of swimming was largely sensual. Now people go to swimming pools and they basically go for enjoyment. Now the devotees were getting their past memories and they're thinking, you know, is this really Krishna conscious? And then they asked Prabhupada, and Prabhupada said, generally if you go to any sacred river, it was the sacred river, then actually we sip a little bit of the water. So Prabhupada said, Prabhupada quoted this verse, we are tasting the water is Krishna. And then Prabhupada says, over it the sun is there. Krishna says, I am the light of the sun. Then we are chanting the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, that is equivalent to Pranava. Pranava is Sarva Vedishu, Om and Hare Krishna are the same. And then Shabdakhe Vaurusham Drishu. Shabdakhe, he said that actually the sound, the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, the Krishna Katha that you are doing, that is also Krishna. And then whatever ability to swim you have, that is also Krishna. So we are surrounded by Krishna everywhere. How can we forget Krishna? And the devotees have been thinking, how can we remember Krishna? So, in this situation, but Prabhupada reveal to them that how, when we understand that Krishna is the essence of everything, then it becomes much easier for us to remember Krishna, because we start seeing Krishna everywhere and in everything. So, this is how this whole section is primarily a means for us to go deeper into the remembrance of Krishna. Let's understand this point of how Krishna is the taste of water once more. So, water makes all other tastes accessible to us. Water makes all other tastes accessible to us, and water gives taste to all the objects that we consider tasty. So through saliva, it makes all other tastes accessible to us, and it gives taste to all other objects, all the objects that we consider tasty. So, as I explain these 2 points, now let's look at other things. So, now we understand, or we consider the essence of the moon and the sun to be their light. You know, if there were no light coming, then we would not consider the sun to be sun, and we would not consider the moon to be moon. So they are the essence, and Krishna says, I am that. Now what does Krishna mean when he says, I am the light of the sun and the moon? Essentially, it is Krishna's energy which manifests through them. It is by Krishna's arrangement that the sun gives light and the moon gives light. Now, science may give us certain mechanisms about how the sun and the moon give light. That is fine. There may be some mechanisms, and we don't have to deny those mechanisms. But those mechanisms are not a complete explanation. Krishna's action is manifested through those mechanisms. We have discussed this earlier also in talking about a billiards ball. When a plus people are playing, the motion of all the balls on the billiard board is as per the rules of mechanics. Because this ball hit this ball with this force, or this stick hit this ball with this force at this angle, therefore the ball over that ball went and hit all those other balls, and eventually that ball went into the hole. That is fine, as far as it goes. But beyond all this is also the trap that there is an expert player who hit that ball with that particular force from that particular angle. So both explanations are complementary, they are not contradictory. So there may be some material mechanism by which things are happening, but overseeing that mechanism is Krishna. He has set up the system and he is overseeing the system. Upadrashta anumanta cha, as we will discuss in 13.23, Krishna says, I am the overseer and the permitter. So, prabhashmi shashi suryayo, pranava sarvavedeshu. The word pranava refers to sound, om. Sarvavedeshu. So, among all the Vedas, I am the pranava. What this means is that the pranava is the, actually it's considered to be the most important among all sounds, om. And this sound, this word om, is related to many of the invocations or words connected with God. If we look at word roots, the study of word roots is called as etymology. So in the Abrahamic traditions, Abrahamic religions are, as we discussed earlier, Judaism, Christianity, Islam. In the Abrahamic traditions, the word Amen or Amin is used. So the root of that and Om is the same. It both come from the same. Similarly, the words Omni are used for referring to attributes of God. So God is omnipresent, omniscient, omnipotent. That means he's present everywhere. He knows everything. He can do everything. So now the word Omni is also coming from the same etymological roots as Om. So in general, the sound Om is considered to be holy. It's connected with the absolute truth. And the important Vedic mantras all generally begin with Om. So Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudeva is an example of one mantra which is associated with the Krishna consciousness process as given by our acharyas to us. We chant this mantra before the Bhagavatam class. So Krishna is saying that actually Now, the Vedas, they contain a lot of instructions. They contain mostly instructions in terms of karma kanda. They talk about how one should engage in sense gratification in a or pursue sense gratification within the precincts of dharma. So dharma, artha, kama. But the Vedas, the transcendental aspect of them is also there in the references to Vishnu, in the glorification of Vishnu, and in the references to Oma, Om. So in that sense, Pranava Sarva Vedeshu means, Krishna is saying that, okay, the Vedas contain many things, but the Vedas also talk ultimately about transcendence. And that transcendence, I am. So Pranava Sarva Vedeshu. So now if the sound Om is so powerful, then can devotees also chant Om, Om, Om? Can we chant Om also? Actually, there is no ban against chanting Om. Now, Om is a powerful sound and it can definitely be chanted. In fact, when we chant, when we get the Gayatri Diksha, the second Brahman Diksha, at that time we get Gayatri Mantra, and devotees also chant Om. So, in general, we prefer the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra because that is the Yuga Dharma for this age. And along with that, Hare Krishna Maha Mantra invokes the Absolute Truth in a personal way. The Omkar is often used by the while referring to the Absolute Truth in a non-personal way. So for example, if there is a Prime Minister of say India, a Prime Minister has a particular name. Now, referring to the Prime Minister by that name is personal. Referring to the Prime Minister by the designation is formal. So, somebody may not even use the word Prime Minister, it is the head of state. The head of state of India has come. That is a designation, but that is definitely not as personal as, say, calling the Prime Minister by one's direct name. And even more direct would be referring to the personal, say, Prime Minister by a nickname. The Prime Minister has a nickname which is known by family members, that would be even more intimate. So like that, the same person can be addressed with different degrees of intimacy. So addressing the Supreme Lord as Krishna, as Govinda, as Gopala, as Yashodanandana, as Shyamasundara, these are all very intimate forms of address. And Om is a very formal, non-personal form of address. I mean, what to speak of calling out to Krishna as the child of Yashodamai, such a specific address, an intimate address. We are, when we use the word Om, we are not even referring to the Absolute Truth of the person. It is a generic reference. It could be used by impersonalists, it could be used by personalists, it could be used by Vaishnavites, it can be used by Vaishnavites also. So it's in that sense a non-descript form of address to the Absolute Truth. Non-descript means that it doesn't contain any description within itself. It is not distinctive in any way. And that's why devotees generally don't use this form of address. But when we're chanting some mantras, if the word Om is there, definitely we can chant it. And if we are doing some yogasanas for health, at that time also, if it is considered that one should chant Om at that time, that also means one can chant it. Certainly there is nothing wrong in chanting Om. But generally because it is a non-personal, non-descript form of address to the Absolute Truth, that's why devotees prefer to address the Lord in more distinctive and personal ways. Now, we discuss about Shabdhake also, that how the ether is the means by which sound is propagated. So therefore Shabdhake and Paurusham Drishu. And Krishna says, I am ability in man. What does this refer to? Actually, it refers to multiple levels. At one level, it refers to the distinctive abilities that different human beings have. So if a person is an excellent speaker, that ability to speak comes from Krishna. If a person is an excellent corporate leader, that ability comes from Krishna. So whatever ability the person has, that comes from Krishna. Now, however, Paurusham Rishu. Rishu refers to human being, in general human beings, Paurusha. Paurusha is the ability. So actually it is human beings who have the ability to do get things done in terms of improving themselves internally. Now all living beings have their bodily urges. Eating, sleeping, mating, defending. But it is only human beings who have the capacity to go beyond these bodily urges and to rise to something higher. So that something higher, the ability to control one's impulses with one's intelligence, is a distinctive ability of human beings. And that is what opens the doorway to transcendental realization. And in that sense, Paurusha and Paurusham Nirshu, the distinctive ability of human beings, which can catapult them on the spiritual path, which opens the doorway to spiritual advancement for them, that distinctive ability is Krishna. So the ability is Krishna. Now Prabhupada explains that so now we will see something very striking in the purport. We discussed earlier in the purport of 7.7 when Mattah Parataram Na Anyad. So just one purport earlier Prabhupada said that actually, there is some common controversy between personalists and impersonalists. And the Bhagavad Gita, as far as the Bhagavad Gita is concerned, it's very clear that the absolute truth is a person. And that is said again and again. And this particular verse is Krishna saying, Mattah Parataram Nani. There is nothing higher than me. It's not that there is some other impersonal Brahman that is higher than me. But here Krishna is saying, Prabhupada is saying in the purport, there is no controversy at all. So practically speaking, Prabhupada says over here, there is no conflict between personalism and impersonalism. One who knows God knows that the impersonal conception and personal conception are simultaneously present in everything and that there is no contradiction. And therefore, we have the achintya bheda bheda tattva. So now when we say impersonal conception and personal conception are simultaneously present, what does it mean? Actually, just as the sun as a specific entity and the sun is an all-pervasive light. Both are present. Similarly, Krishna has both these manifestations. And all these manifestations, both these manifestations exist eternally. So the focus is different for different transcendentalists. So when, what is the controversy? The controversy is not whether the two features exist or not. The controversy comes up, which feature is the highest? So the impersonalist not only consider that the impersonal not only consider that the personal aspect is the lower one and the impersonal is the highest, but the Mayavadis go so far as to say that actually the personal aspect is just a convenient fiction. It doesn't really exist. It is just a convenient fiction that we use. Oh, there is a particular form of the Lord. And there is a particular God who is above all the other gods and he has this form, he has these features, he has these pastimes. All this is a convenient fiction that we ultimately must transcend so that we can attain the real realization. That conception is what created the controversy. But the Bhagavad Gita understanding and the Vaishnava understanding in general is very clear that both the aspects are there. So when we understand that both exist simultaneously, then there is no need for controversy. So, Prabhupada concludes in this purport that the jurisdiction of Krishna consciousness extends everywhere. The jurisdiction of Krishna consciousness extends everywhere. One who knows Krishna consciousness is blessed. Those who do not know Krishna are an illusion. And so, knowledge of Krishna is liberation and ignorance of Him is bondage. So, the jurisdiction of Krishna consciousness exists everywhere. This is significant usage, jurisdiction. Normally we use the word jurisdiction. Say a particular, if there's a crime happens in a particular area and then somebody has been visiting that area and that person goes back to one's own place and they say, oh, I was robbed over here or I was abused over there. Then the question comes up, okay, you belong to this area, you were abused in that area, robbed in that area. So under whose jurisdiction that comes? So then they will decide, okay, then actually you should register in that police station. And then they will take a complaint over there. FIR will be filed over there. So like that, the question of jurisdiction comes up in practically so many areas. But jurisdiction of Krishna consciousness extends everywhere. This means that we can be Krishna conscious everywhere. You know, it is Krishna's energy which pervades everything, and if we want, we can remember Krishna anywhere and everywhere. In that sense, actually Krishna consciousness is the ultimate perfection of life. And in that sense, the jurisdiction of Krishna consciousness extends everywhere, everywhere. So knowledge of Krishna is liberation. The more we know about Krishna, the more we advance. And if we don't know about Krishna, then we stay in bondage, we stay in illusion. So essentially, the whole Bhagavad Gita is going to reveal to us how we can see the connection of everything with Krishna. Inability to see the connection of things with Krishna is the cause of bondage. And the ability to see our connection of things with Krishna will be the cause of liberation. So let's look at the 7.9 now. Punyo gandha prithivyam cha tejas chasmi vibhavasa jivanam sarva bhuteshu tapaschasmi tapasvishu. So punyo gandha prithivyam cha. So I am the fragrance of the earth. Tejas chasmi vibhavasa. So vibhavasa refers to fire. I am the heat of fire. Jivanam sarva bhuteshu. I am the life of all that lives. And tapaschasmi tapasvishu. I am the austerity of the austere. So we discussed earlier, punyo gandha prithivyam cha. What does this refer to? We discussed how the earth, its defining, its associated sense object is fragrance in the Sankhya system of evolution. So in that sense, the punyo gandha prithivyam cha refers to how the fragrance is the essence of the earth, and that fragrance is manifested through Krishna. Now we also see that this fragrance is quite extraordinary, in the sense that we may plant a seed in the earth. Now the seed has no fragrance, and then we nourish the seed with water. That also doesn't have any fragrance. But if we are doing horticulture, we are doing simple gardening also. Say we are planting trees that will give blossoms, flowers. So when the flower comes out, at that time the flower has a charming fragrance. So where did this fragrance come from? The fragrance was not there in the seed, the fragrance was not there in the water. Yet when we put the seed in the earth and nourish it with water, we have the fragrance over there. So that has come from the earth. Especially in the rainy season, when the fresh rainy seasons, when the first rains come at that time, we can also feel the fragrance of the earth. So these are just general examples about understanding from our experience how fragrance is associated with the earth. But the point is that there is a experiential understanding and a conceptual understanding of this. So the conceptual understanding is that in Sankhya, fragrance is associated with earth. Then tejas chasmi vibhavaso. So vibhavaso. Vibhavaso means fire. So actually, with sun and moon, generally we talk about it in terms of light, first of all. The sun also gives heat, and the moonlight is considered to be cooling. But generally we talk about sun in terms of light, primarily. And secondarily, of course, heat is also important. So here Krishna is distinguishing. He says, I am the light of sun, but now he's saying, I am the heat of fire. Either way, the point is that how there are things which there are various things in this world, and all of them have certain essential characteristics which are important for us. So when it's cold, at that time people light a fire, or we may have a heating system. So even the heating system is basically giving out, it's involving some fire which gives out heat. So I am the heat of fire means we are attracted to fire because it has its essential element of heat. And Krishna says, I am that heat. So then, jivanam sarva bhuteshu. So how is life present in all living beings? Sarva bhuteshu. Actually, life itself is a great mystery in the perspective of modern science. How does life come about? So many scientists, they reject the conception of a soul, because they say if soul is there, how is the soul going to affect matter? Their idea is the soul is spiritual, and because the soul is spiritual, so being spiritual, the soul cannot understand. Or rather, the soul cannot affect matter, because matter, their idea, is affected by material forces. So how does the soul affect matter? That is a problem that has perplexed Western thought. And because of that, in Western intellectual history, the concept of soul was largely neglected. But the Vedic conception is that actually the soul and the matter interact through the super soul. So the super soul is the controller of both spirit and matter. And the super soul can affect matter. And of course, the super soul can use material mechanism also to affect matter. So that mechanism is actually misidentification. So, but the point is that what defines all living beings is their life. And where does that life come from? Ultimately, it comes from Krishna. The soul who gives life is a part of Krishna. And the arrangement by which the soul is able to manifest the life through matter, that is also coming from Krishna. So, Jivanam Sarvabhuteshu Tapascha Asmi Tapasvishu. So, Tapasvishu refers to those who are austere. Now, austerity, the capacity for austerity is also extraordinary. Some people can, when we do Nirjala Ekadashi fasting, one day to live without water seems to be so difficult. And then some devotees may do fasting on just without any water or just on water. Every Ekadashi, there are some people who can fast for not just one day, but 3 days, 5 days. Some people can fast for 10 days, 15 days. When Vishwamitra Muni, who earlier was a king named Kaushika of Kaushala Desh, so he went to the ashram of Vasishtha. So at that time, it is described that there were many, many sages over there, and all of them were practicing austerities. So it is said that there were different levels of sages. So the most austere among those sages were living on air. That's all. They would breathe air and that would survive. And then there were other sages who would live on water. And it was said that among the austere sages, the least austere were those who were considered to eat leaves. So those who would eat leaves are considered to be the least austere. Now today, if somebody was going to live on leaves only, you would consider that person, what kind of capacity of austerity that person has. So the point is, the capacity for austerity is extraordinary. And that capacity for austerity ultimately comes from Krishna. So if Krishna can give different abilities to different people, and he gives the capacity for austerity to certain people. So when we see certain people with certain attributes, we can respect those people for those attributes, but instead of becoming envious of those people's attributes, we can see that those attributes are coming from Krishna. And that way we can make spiritual advancement by connecting everything with Krishna. So then, Prabhupada explains in many practical ways also, or Punya Gandha Prithi, each of these he explains how these are important. So now another point about life is, Jivanam Sarvam Bhuteshu, is that actually life and death are not actually in our hands. You know, doctors treat, but it is God who heals. You know, doctors can offer the medicine, they can do the surgery, they can do whatever else is required. But ultimately, you know, they say that medicine is not an exact science. So we can, normally if you have exact science, we'll say, okay, you take this much chemical, you mix this much chemical, you'll get this much result, this result. But in medical science, yes, we can have to some extent, okay, you take this medicine, this is, you'll be cured. But different people have different backgrounds. Who knows what the case background is? Who knows what circumstances they are? What infections they have been exposed to, or they are being exposed to, and how certain things may interact with certain other things to produce certain results, we can't say. So that's why there are many examples of people who get a small disease which can be very easily cured, and that disease becomes so severe, despite all the best medicines from the best doctor, the person just dies because of a trivial disease. So on the other hand, some people may have a terrible disease and the doctor may say, you are going to die in 6 months. And then that person attends the funeral of the doctor. So the person outlives the doctor. So how does this happen? You know, life and death are ultimately not in our hands. So life and death are ultimately determined by Krishna. So Krishna is the giver of life. Krishna is ultimately the taker of life. So it's not that Krishna has a vengeance against someone and Krishna takes life. But the karmic reactions for every soul are given in different ways by Krishna. So then Prabhupada says, Prabhupada makes the same point in this purport also, that Krishna consciousness is active in every sphere. So now it's interesting, Prabhupada personifies Krishna consciousness here. That means, you know, say, Prabhupada isn't, instead of saying that we can be Krishna consciousness in every sphere, instead of that, or we can be actively Krishna conscious in every sphere, Prabhupada, Krishna consciousness is active in every sphere. That means the capacity for Krishna consciousness is latent in all spheres. We just have to tap that for capacity. And then when we tap that capacity, then we can be Krishna conscious also. So let's look at the next verse. So in this previous verse we had four attributes which we talked about. So first verse was five, then there are four. Now let us discuss. Bijam mam sarvabhutanam vindhipartha sanatanam buddhir buddhimatam asmi tejas tejasvinamaham. So here Krishna talks about three more attributes, making the total of 12 till now. So bijam mam sarvabhutanam, I am the seed of all living beings. Vidhipartha sanatanam, I am the eternal seed, imperishable seed, indestructible seed. What does it mean? This can be connected with our earlier discussion of Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamadachyate Purnasti Purnamadaya Purnam Eva Vashishyate. So when many completes come out of the complete, still the original remains the complete. The complete remains the complete. So normally when a seed gives rise to something, at that time that thing gets destroyed. So when the seed gives rise to a tree, and the seed no longer exists, the seed gets transformed into a tree. So similarly, when an embryo is formed, first there is an egg and then the embryo is formed. When the embryo gives rise to a child, then the embryo no longer exists. So Krishna says normally the seed doesn't exist. And one seed gives only one kind of tree. But Krishna says that I am the seed that gives all kinds of trees. That means all living beings, whatever exists, it comes from me. So I am the seed. But another thing he says is, I am the seed which never gets exhausted. Sanatanam. So all the living beings, all the variety that exists in the universe, that all has come from Krishna. But still, Krishna remains the original truth. Krishna remains sanatanam, imperishable truth. Buddhir buddhimatam asmi. Krishna says that I am the intelligence of the intelligent. Some people, we say they have brilliant intelligence. The way they recollect, the way they express, the way they analyze, they stupefy people. So when we see this, we understand that is the defining characteristic of these brilliant people. Their brilliance, the intellect of the intellectuals. So where does this come from? This comes from Krishna. And similarly, Tejas Tejas Vinamaham. Tejas Tejas Vinamaham means that I am the power of the powerful. Some people are powerful, they have this tremendous body. And they can just, one punch can knock out somebody else. Such people are attracted to others. I mean, they are attracted to others. What we have to recognize is, yes, they have power, but their power ultimately comes from Krishna. It is Krishna who is making them powerful. And then Prabhupada quotes again the standard Ittu Nityanam verse. And then let's move forward to the next verse. Balam Balavat. So 11th verse now. So till now we have got 12 attributes Krishna has talked about. Krishna will talk about two more in this verse. Balam Balavatam Chaham Kamaraga Vivarjitam Dharma Viruddho Bhuteshu Kamosmi Bharatarshabha. So Balam Balavatam Chaham. Krishna says, I am the strength of the strong. But what kind of strength? Kamaraga Vivarjitam. That which is free from desire and lust, desire and attachment. And then he says, Dharma Viruddho Bhuteshu. That which is aviruddha,
not opposed to dharma, that kind of kama, that kind of desire, I am, that kind of kama. Now here Prabhupada, it's interesting that Krishna uses the word kama twice in this verse. So in the first time he uses it, and it's 7.11b, kama raga vivarjitam. So Krishna is first area, when you talk about strength, that strength should be free from desire and attachment. That means kshatriyas, for example, when they act, they should act out of dharma. They should act as duty, as protectors of others. Kshatatrayate iti kshatriya. Those who protect others from hurt, kshata is hurt, they are called as kshatriyas. Now, dharma aviruddhat bhuteshu kama usmi vatashu. So now Krishna uses the word kama once again in the next line. And what is he saying over there when he's using it? He's saying that that kama, which is not contrary to dharma, I am that. So what does this mean? Actually, there is dharma, artha, kama and moksha. So that means actually there are these different elements which all form a part of life. So it's not that kama has to be entirely given up. So when we talk about kama, it can refer to various things. And we have to look at the context. Here, in the same verse, kama is used twice. And first Krishna is saying, I should be free from kama. And then he's saying, I am kama. So what is he referring to over here? So the word is kama. Do not each case have the same, in both cases have the same meaning. First, kama refers to desire in general, and desire and attachment, which one should give up while employing one's strength, a desire in terms of selfish desire. And then when Krishna is talking about kama, he's talking about kama as one of the purusharthas. So purushartha, the purpose of living beings, especially human beings, purushas. So when in the Mahabharata the sages meet sometimes sages visit Yudhishthira Maharaj. For example, Narada Muni visits Yudhishthira Maharaj and he inquires from him. So normally, you know, for grahasthas and for sannyasis, the modes of inquiry are different. When Dashrath Maharaj sees Vishwamitra Muni, he honors him and respects him and says that, how are you progressing in your conquest over rebirth? The purpose of sannyas is that a person wants to renounce the world and end the cycle of birth and death and go back to the spiritual world. So that whole idea is conquering over rebirth. So the sannyasis ask the question, how can you conquer, how is your conquest over rebirth going? But when the sages like say Narada Muni asks Yudhishthira Maharaj in the Mahabharata, he's asking, oh king, are you having a balance between religion, profit and pleasure? So what religion is dharma, profit is artha, and pleasure is kama. So he says, you know, those who pursue only religion and give up profit and pleasure, or those who pursue only profit and give up religion and pleasure, or those who pursue only pleasure and give up religion and profit, they are all living imbalanced lives and they will not be satisfied. But if they balance this, then they can be satisfied. So now, when we talk about pleasure, when you talk about artha, it is not just bank balance. Artha is holistic prosperity in terms of having the necessities of life without having too much anxieties and having natural comforts. So Vrindavan is a place where there's artha in terms of financial. It's a comfortable place. The Prajavasis work hard, but along with that, they're also comfortable. Dharma, artha, kama. So kama refers to not just sensual gratification in terms of lust. It refers to the overall satisfaction of one's family life. So here when Krishna is saying dharma viruddha bhuteshu kamosmi, he is saying that the kama, the sex life that is not contrary to dharma, that I am. Bharatar Shiva, I am that. So what does this refer to? This actually refers to how Krishna is encouraging Arjuna to recognize that in all aspects of life one can manifest, one can perceive Krishna's presence. So even in kama, even in Even the and then in the pleasure of family life, even Prabhupada uses Kamada refer to lust over sex life over here. So I am sex life that is not contrary to religious principles. So that means when there is dharma, that is when within the precincts of dharma kama is pursued, then that kama is not necessarily is not mundane. That kama can actually be divine. So some people say that is, you know, is sex taboo in the Vedic culture. Now, taboo is that which is not to be talked about, that is considered to be very bad. No, sex is considered to be a manifestation of the divine. But then when it is a manifestation of the divine, it has to be understood and understood properly. So actually when people glamorize sex, they trivialize it. How is it? When people glamorize it in their imagination more and more, then what is the glamorization centered on? It's centered primarily on looks and physical contacts and pleasure. So now what is the pleasure which most people, which most depictions of sex, glamorized depictions of sex ultimately focus on? That pleasure is basically, you know, secretion, ejection and reception of chemicals. That's all that is. So now, the more people glamorize sex in their imagination, the more they trivialize it in their real life. Because that which can be an experience of God, if it is done properly within the precincts of dharma, that becomes reduced to something which is just physical. It just becomes a tool for some physical release, that's all. So that is a trivialization of sex. So it's not that sex is considered taboo. Is the Vedic culture against sex? No, sex is a natural part of life, but it has to be made. It has to be kept as a proper part of life, not made the whole purpose, central purpose of life, not made the constant object of thought, and not certainly made into a trivial activity that just one does for gaining a little bit of release. It's a dharmic activity when it is done in the precincts of dharma. So Krishna is saying, avriddha bhuteshu kamosmi. When it is not opposed to dharma, then that life is, that is actually, that sex life is an expression, experience of Krishna. So now Krishna will give a conclusion to this section. He will describe, ye chaiva sattvika bhava rajasastamasaschaye mattai veditan vidhi natvaham teshu te mai. So he is saying that till now he has given 14 examples, and after giving these 14 examples, he gives a general principle. Actually, all these are present within the three modes. So some are sattvika bhava, some are rajasa bhava, some are tamasa bhava. So here bhava refers to nature. So some of them are in goodness, passion, some are in passion, some in ignorance. So now whatever, everything that exists, that will be in the three modes. It exists in material existence, that has to be in some way, in the three modes, in some combination. But all these three, matta eve titan vidhi, they all come from me. So Krishna has given 14 specific examples of how he is the essence of things. But he is saying ultimately, everything that exists, its essence is ultimately me. It's all present within the three modes. And matta eve ti, it all comes from me. But tan vidhi, Arjuna, no. That tan vidhi is there because Arjuna understands that ultimately everything is coming from me. Its essence is me. Its source is me. But natvaham teshu temai. But don't think that I am reduced only to this. That means I am just existing everything as an amorphous essence. No, I have my own distinct concrete personality and my own individuality and my life. Natvaham teshu temai. It's not that I am within them. Rather, they are within me. This is one of my energies, as Krishna has talked about, apara prakriti. So he's talking here about the two, saying that everything exists, it's within three modes, and all of it comes from me. But I'm not reduced to it. So Krishna is never contained within nature. Krishna transcends nature. So after giving the example of the essence, so first Krishna has given in 7.7 the example, Sutre Maniganaiva. I am the unifying underlying thread of everything. Now that would mean that Krishna is just the thread, nothing more. But no, Krishna is saying, yes, I am the thread, I underline and unify everything, but I am much more. natvaham teshu. A thread is inside the necklace and thread is not anywhere else. But here Krishna is saying that, yes, the thread is there inside the necklace, but I am distinctive also. I have my own separate existence. They are me, I am not in them. So when Krishna has said that, he has said that I am in them earlier, rasohamapsukaunte. He is there, but his existence is also beyond. He is transcendental also. How he is transcendental and what the transcendence of Krishna implies, that we'll discuss in our next class. Thank you. Hare Krishna.